unsurpassed
penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good afternoon. We have another beautiful day in the Shishin. It's amazing. The weather is so beautiful. Not too hot, not too warm. We've had some extremely hot days up here sometimes, and at this time of the year. Can you hear me, Dennis? No? I'll speak louder. Is that better? Sounds like I'm screaming with what I've got on here. Thank you. Just let me know if you don't hear me, this, I'll know what's going on. So, we've been talking about the Shobogenzo, Mountains and Rivers Sutra, and it's fairly complex and deep, and I think some people might have gotten a little bit irritated with the complexity and the non-understanding of the words, which is quite understandable and reasonable. So I thought I'd take a little bit different approach today, read some, but talk more about it, and maybe start off with the word Shobogenzo itself, which is interesting. It's the name of the entire work, which is hundreds of pages long, and it's kind of a meta message as to what we're doing with anything in this treasured piece of work. But it means true Dharma eye. And his fascicles are about teaching the true Dharma eye, the opening of the Dharma eye. And this particular one, Mountains and Rivers, is pretty craggy and deep in the water and high in the mountains. And it's difficult to follow where he's going with it. It's good to understand that he studied as a Tendai monk before he went to China. And he was ordained as a monk. And he and his master went to China. The Tendai practice, which I'm not familiar with, is largely based on the Lotus Sutra, which has very similar understandings. It is the same as the Prajnaparamita Sutra, which is Soto school. Prizes, treasures. Not that it doesn't treasure the Lotus Sutra too, but it focuses on that, I think it's fair to say. The Lotus Sutra is a work that teaches and manifests the interdependent origination of all things, all beings. And I think this sutra that Dogen is presenting to us is of that quality. I think they're all of that quality, but this one especially so. And some of the words he uses are difficult to comprehend because he's thinking of certain concepts or words or experiences in the Lotus Sutra. So I'd like to just skip around in this work and read a passage or two and talk about it and see if we can make some sense of it. Dogen is a Sherpa, he's more of a Sherpa of being on top of these mountains and in these deep, deep waters with his own experiences. And he sees with that Dharma eye at the craggy peaks and the heights. And he calls us to open our Dharma eye to the same capacity, same vision as him. It's difficult to do that by reading. I don't know if it's possible, but it's a call to practice. And what reminds me of is Koban's practice. For years he practiced and we couldn't understand a thing he said. But a phrase or two would jump out and we'd grab those and exchange those at the end of the teisho. We're having tea. And that's the way we learned. But it was mostly incomprehensible, just like Dogen. And I think a lot of that is skillful means. But if you try to understand this, you're not going to do it. You've got to practice to get to where he's at. It's a call to practice. It's a metta call to practice. So that's the first thing. And the second thing about Koban was you never gave up on it. It was such a wonderful practice and such a wonderful teisho that you didn't understand it, but when you came out, you were cleansed. It was like a Dharma shower. You felt invigorated and cleansed and wonderful and were happy and didn't understand a thing, but came back the next week for sure. And that could go on for years. It did go on for years. And the message was carried out. You can't understand this. And I'm not presenting it to understand. I'm presenting it as the truth, which is not understandable. But you need to hear it anyway. And we did. And we remained and came back and practiced and practiced and practiced. So it's more like that, I think, with Dogen, a metta call to practice. But let's take a look at some of the things that are in here. And we'll start with the end. The last couple of paragraphs, he says this: there are mountains hidden in treasures. There are mountains hidden in swamps. Everything is connected from beginningless time. There are mountains hidden in the sky. Mountains hidden in mountains, self-studying self. There are mountains hidden in hiddenness, dark and dark. This is how we study. We study where we are, how we are, as is, whatever is in front of us. An ancient Buddha said, mountains are mountains, waters are waters. These words do not mean mountains are mountains. They mean mountains are mountains. Mountains are mountains is ordinary view. Mountains are mountains is Dharma view. Same view. Same view. But different Dharma eye. Dharma eye is deeper and sees mountains are mountains. Those mountains are interconnected timelessly. It's a central teaching of this fascicle by Dogen. In this way, he says, investigate mountains thoroughly. When you investigate mountains thoroughly, this becomes the endeavor within the mountains. We and the mountains are one. We study the mountains as humans. We actualize our way as humans. And the mountains actualize their way as mountains. Every creature is in the Dharma, of the Dharma essence, inseparable from that Dharma essence, and practices, actualizes, manifests in its own Dharma condition. Like a tree or a mammal. Such waters and mountains of themselves become wise persons and sages. Wise persons and sages are connected intimately with mountains and waters and everything else. Know that mountains are not the realm of human beings or the realm of heavenly beings. That's a dichotomy. We're not in the realm of duality here. And Dogen is not talking in a duality sense or program. Do not view mountains from the standard of human thought, ordinary language. The mountain is a mountain. If you do not judge mountains flowing by the human understanding of flowing, you will not doubt mountains flowing and not flowing. Mountains flow with everything, with us, with everything that exists. It flows together in the Dharma. The light and love of the Dharma exists in mountains and us and everything, and flows in emptiness. You may think that in mountains many wise people and great sages are assembled. But after entering the mountains, not a single person meets another. There is just the vital activity of the mountains. There is no trace of anyone having entered the mountains. Dogen was in the hall practicing, sitting on one night in the early morning. And Rujing, his master, came in and saw him sitting and saw the other monks in the hall sleeping. Monks in China slept in the hall for hundreds of years. We slept in here 35, 40 years ago, the early days, during Shishin. So he comes in and he sees the sleeping monks, and he kind of laces into them chides them a bit for sleeping when they could be sitting. And at that, Dogen went through a deep realization. And he soon thereafter walked into the master's quarters to get confirmed. And he was. And Rujing said, "No trace remains." He said, "No trace remains." Dogen was a little bit concerned about that he wasn't tested deeply enough. "No trace remains. Are you sure?" Rujing was sure. And Dogen accepted it. But that "no trace" is right here back in Dogen. You may think that in mountains many wise people and great sages are assembled. But after entering the mountains, Dogen and Zendo, not a single person meets another. Eternal interconnectionists. There is just the vital activity of the mountains, manifesting Buddha Dharma. There is no trace of anyone having entered the mountains. No thing. No anyone. When you see mountains from the ordinary world, and you see meet mountains while in mountains, the mountain's head and eye are viewed quite differently. The head and eye of a mountain. We think of these mountains and other non-human, non-mammal, non-sentient beings as inanimate, but that's not true. The Dharma lives in everything. The light, love of the Dharma, is alive in everything. No exceptions. Or it wouldn't be in existence. So, quite different. Your idea or view of mountains not flowing is not the same as the view of dragons and fish. Dragons are an ancient Chinese symbol of clarity and enlightenment. And he's saying the ordinary view of mountains not flowing is different from enlightened views. Human and heavenly beings have attained a position concerning their own worlds that other beings may doubt or may not have the capacity to doubt. Do not remain bewildered and skeptical when you hear these words, mountains flow, but study these words with Buddha ancestors. So you see, it's all about study. It's all about practice. He uses that word study, but he's talking about practice. Sitting and kinhin and our daily life. Live with a clear-minded view of samadhi. That practice. He's calling us to get deeper into our practice so that we can see more clearly the truth of our lives and our reality. And he goes about it in myriad ways, and there's many trails, but that's the message. The message is do not be deluded by what you see in this ordinary world. It's more. It's the same and more when the Dharma eye is opened. He's calling us to open those Dharma eyes. And dear Sangha, I call you to engage in discussing. That's how we get our Dharma eye open, is practice and discussion. So if any of those things resonate, let's talk, please. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
I'm not sure, but I feel like mountains and waters are also Zen. Don't they have don't they mean something? It's like wisdom and emotions or something. I don't know.
No, I think not. I think not, because the emotions and the wisdom would be more ordinary world type things. The wisdom not. I mean, the wisdom is the prajna, and that's how you get the Dharma eye opened. But the emotions are what they are. And I don't think that would be that would be the correct statement. Could you say it again, please?
I was just saying that I think in some Zen literature, mountains and waters are used, you know, it's a euphemism for wisdom and emotions. But I can't think of where that comes from.
Oh, I see. You mean as metaphors?
Yeah, metaphors.
Okay.
So that, like, sometimes Dogen is talking about mountains, and sometimes he's talking about practice or, like, deep wisdom.
Well, he is. Exactly, he is. He's talking prajna. That's prajna. Mountains flowing and mountains walking is prajna. When a caterpillar walks across the table, those mountains are walking. Everything is connected. When we walk, it's connected. I mentioned the last talk about when Bodhidharma was going back to India. He was over 100, 105 or something. And he called his three disciples together. And he asked them to manifest the Buddha Dharma. And he would select one of them to be his heir. The first one made a statement. The second one made a statement. And Huike, our ancestor, said nothing. He did a deep gassho. And he turned the universe. And Bodhidharma said, "You have my marrow." He transmitted him. Now, did Bodhidharma have emotions with that? I suspect he did. But the emotions weren't the cause for Bodhidharma transmitting him. He transmitted because of the truth. The truth meant the truth. He transmitted. Yes.
I've been attracted to Zen because, in addition to so much wisdom of how to live in terms of ethics and understanding kind of the wisdom traditions, the other part of it that's always attracted me has been just what you're kind of pointing to now, which is the unknown or the unknowable, because I sense deeply that in my own life, that it's not just a question of reading a lot of books and figuring things out. But I definitely struggle with what the Dharma gate is for me to be able to access what you're talking about right now. What is that Dharma gate that would allow me to access this? Because I'm struggling with how I would apply it or what it indicates beyond just sitting. And maybe that's it, but I just wonder if there is something else.
Are you asking me how to acquire the Dharma eye or how to manifest the Dharma eye?
Well, it's apparent that you have an insight into these readings. For me, I, like you said, it kind of quoted their darkest darkness. I don't see anything. So what is the Dharma gate that I might, or how might you guide me to kind of leave behind this cognitive mind that I'm so imprisoned with, maybe?
Yes, thank you for the question. It's a perennial question that we all, I think, go through and continue to go through. I think it's practice. It's just practice. There's no end to practice. No matter what you experience, you're still back on that Zafu. Deep practice. All practice. I mean, it's a five-legged stool. Sitting and walking, prostrations and chanting, and Dokusan. And it's good to avail of all of it. They all have methods and all have results in our lives and in opening the Dharma eye, helping us see our true self. It's not complex, it's simple, it's practice. We like to think there's a pill we can take or whatever, but it's practice. Yes, Nico.
Thank you, John. I was thinking of a question that may be very similar to the one that Mark asked, which is, we're being called, I suppose, to open or find the Dharma eye, but what are we supposed to open it to? I mean, I'm hearing a lot of I think the one that I remember from the first time you read through it was the mountains do not obstruct the mountains, or there was some. There are always these relationships between self and self and self and some other. You see it in the Heart Sutra where this does not differ from that, and that does not differ from this. And there's always these relationships being set up. They all seem to be pointing to the same thing. But so what is it that we're actually seeing other than that? I mean, I think that that's a useful thing to work with. What is it that we're actually supposed to be seeing to open the Dharma eye, but to what? And why?
Well, when the Dharma eye is open, there's no inside and outside. You don't see anything.
Right. Right. There's, it's...
We live in a sea of vast emptiness.
How is this in any way applied, and what is it applied to? That might be a better way of forming my question.
Applied to what?
I don't know. Applied to what we do when we're not in the Zendo. Applied to politics. Applied to the course of human events.
Well, that's the ordinary life, you know. That's our life, ordinary life that we lead, our non-dual life. But our ordinary life is loaded with dualities of this and that, and competition and fights and wild politics and partisanship, and that's ordinary life. But you don't see, the Dharma world is connected. There's none of that. None of that stuff going on or even considered there. That's all human activity. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying that's the way it is. It's just human activity. We can do that human activity with a Dharma consciousness, and I doubt we'd be doing a lot of that stuff.
But we would still have to be doing something.
Yes, you'd be teaching.
Sorry?
You'd be doing a lot of things.
Right. Because that world, those are still, I mean, that is still the Dharma world, no? I mean, it seems
it is.
That all Dharmas are marked in these ways. So.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'm not sure I know.
Well, this is the Dharma world.
Yes.
Yeah, we're here. We don't have to go anywhere.
Right.
So you can practice right here.
Thank you.
So do you ever despair that this practice is enough to move through this world? Or what do you do if you do despair?
Well, I've never gotten into despair, so I can't answer that honestly. I've never gotten into despair, so I can't answer that honestly. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I were in despair what I would do with this practice. It might be something to see a professional about.
About
despair, yeah. Because a practitioner, a teacher, wouldn't necessarily be getting into that kind of a spiritual sickness.
So you're saying that's separate from the rest of the Dharma, to have despair?
No, if we have physical conditions like mental or physical ailments, we should take advantage of whatever support we can get in the ordinary world. We don't have to leave the ordinary world. It's good. It's fine. We just got to see it more clearly and not get locked into it as an ultimate reality when it's an illusionary reality. The Buddha was very clear. He said, this life is like a dream.
I'm sorry?
He said, this life is like a dream.
Life is like a dream.
Like a dream. Let's say we're in a nightmare and somebody's chasing us, and they've got a weapon, and they're getting closer. And we wake up, and we're in a pool of perspiration, and they have a charley horse in our leg. And we say, ah, that was a dream. I thought it was real. But it was real. You got perspiration in the bed, you got a charley horse in the leg. It was real. It was a lived experience. But it wasn't in this state, it was in the dream state. It's the same thing with our life. We think this is real, and it is real. But it's a dream, it's an illusion. We live in a world of dualities, and the Dharma doesn't have those dualities. So the sutra is very clear on that, no extinguishment.
No,
no extinguishment.
No. extinguishment.
Doesn't make any sense in ordinary life. If we read the sutra, if we read Dogen, we'll go around those curves, those mountain passes for a long time. It doesn't make sense. It can produce frustration. So practice is necessary to get us out of our thinking mind. We create many of these problems. Our thinking. It's wonderful here in this ordinary life, but it creates a lot of difficulty for us. So our practice is in silence and beyond words and concepts. So we speak, and a lot of that is going to lead to confusion too. Because words are like labels. If we fix on those ideas, those labels, we could get in difficulty. Because the Dharma is boundless, eternal. And here we are, people, trying to figure it out and make decisions on things like that. It's pretty laughable when you get right down to it. The hubris we've got.
What life do we realize the Dharma in?
The same life you got. It's the only life we have.
And it's real when we realize it?
It's real right now.
It's not a dream?
It's a dream and it's real. It's real. You can hear, yeah, yeah. You can hear it. Good question. That should be explored. That should be explored. Excuse me, yes.
So there's something that brings me to the practice, and I'm not sure what it is. Is it possible that the Dharma eye doesn't, I mean, the whole of Zen literature seems to, at least the koans seem to suggest that people are stumbling around in the dark and suddenly they wake up, they realize. Is it possible that you just kind of wake up a little bit and that's what drives you to the practice? Are we looking for the home run and maybe a sacrifice fly is good?
I think everybody gets a call for their own purposes, whether it's bumping into a friend who's doing this or reading a book or having an experience in a foreign land or whatever it might be, they get a kind of a wake up, a little bit, hey, something more going on here than I ever dreamed of. Shakespeare had that notion too. So, yeah, I think we get different kinds of hints about what's going on. I mean, this is our essence. We're not searching for something that's foreign to us. The Buddha Dharma is our vital essence. So we don't have to go searching. We may get a tap on the inside of that egg.
I guess the question I had is it me that's looking for this thing, or does the universe come in? Is the universe tapping me on the shoulder?
I don't know. I mean, you know that you have the experience, so you could investigate that. But it sounds like you are here. You are here. And a lot of times we don't know how we got here, what we're doing here. But we know we need to be here. We know we need to be here. Everybody knows that their own way. And I wouldn't put that aside. I would follow up on that. What caused you to be here? And trust that. trust that guidance that you got to start this practice. You can trust your own guidance. That's straight from Kogan. Yes.
I feel like when we study the natural laws, which is the only thing we have in hands here, we see some sort of an autonomous system happening here with great order. Everything happens right in time and perfectly right. So trillions of cells in our body, which each have an identity in a way, but they're all working in an autonomous way. They trust this system and it works. Now, I don't know if they know that the brain calls for the cell or if the cell calls for the brain, but it's working autonomously. There's a trust happening. So when we zoom out, I feel like each one of us, if we are those cells and we're part of this larger ecosystem, then there is some autonomous force that is actually handling everything. Yeah, we each have to take our own steps, but with this practice, what drew me was the fact that sitting on the cushion, I realized a space in between two thoughts while breathing. And I was able to pause in between these thoughts that all seemed like stories that really didn't have any truth to them, which is what's the illusion. I don't know anything but I'm thinking. We barely know about ourselves, let alone others. And as this space grows, I feel like there's a trust, I'm starting to trust something. So there is something that I feel, and when I trust it in silence, it leads me towards the right direction. And I don't necessarily take steps towards it, but it also comes to me. So when I hear the mountains and the waters and what we study with Angie, it feels like, yeah, we are all moving together and we're all part of the same energy, just manifesting in different forms and in different ways. So maybe the Dharma eye is just like realizing that collectiveness, because we get trapped into tagging and separating ourselves from one another, from whether it's people or mountains or waters, are all the same. They're all energy, everything is just energy. And energy flows if you don't clock it. So maybe trusting work? I don't know how it works, but it does. You think it happens. Next day, you wake up, it's there. Exactly what you wanted. And when I don't sit, that doesn't happen because I keep thinking and I stop the process. That autonomous process that I can't go out to see because it's bigger than us. Maybe. But that's just a personal experience, and through learning with Angie, that's how it feels like. She says, I'm attached to the chair, and the chair is attached to the floor, and the floor is attached, and then at the end we're like floating on this green and blue planet, you know, that's part of the vast space. So there's an interconnection.
There is. And then there's a connectedness beyond that interconnectedness. You know, our thinking world, you know, can show the connectedness. And we show that in many ways in science, even Heisenberg's theory. You know, there's a lot of things that go on that are quite unusual. But this interconnectedness is a flow and a connection of the Dharma with everything that ever was and is and ever will be. So it blows the rational mind completely out of the water. The first sentence of Mountains and Waters Sutra has that as a statement when you unpack it.
What does it say, that first sentence?
Well, let's see. Mountains and waters right now actualize the ancient Buddha expression. The ancient each abiding in its condition unfolds its full potential. Because mountains and waters have been active since before the empty eon, they are alive at this moment. Because they have been the self since before form arose, they are emancipation actualized. Because mountains are high and broad, their way of riding the clouds always extends from the mountains. Their wondrous power of soaring in the wind comes freely from the mountains. Dogen is a great poet, and the first sentence describes the connection, and then he gets into the poetry of the wind and the mountains and the water and the It's all connected. That word is improper and it's not true, but it's a word. We got to use words. It's a flow. It's a flow, the flow of the Buddha Dharma. Nothing is separate from that. There was some work that Stephen Hawking's the great physicist, astrophysicist that died a few years ago. He, in the Grand Design, mentioned that they have the mathematics now at Cambridge to show that the universe is one of a series, an infinite series of parallel universes, the one we live in. And our teaching here is that boundless. So we have a lot of words that we could say, don't know. Boundless, put that tag in there, don't know. Eternal, don't know. Infinite series of parallel universes, don't know. In 1,000 years from now, they'll have science that probably completely overturns that. So we're sitting here in a place of honesty and knowledge, really. We say, don't know. That's the highest mind of this practice. When we know something, we're filled and we can't learn more. There's that old story of the professor that went to visit the Zen master in Japan, and the master was serving tea. He brought out some tea cups and a teapot, and he's pouring the tea into the professor's cup. The professor had been talking for about a half hour, an hour, on and on about this and about that. And he pours the water in there, and the tea overflows the cup. And he says, why? You're filling that cup and it's overflowing. Why are you doing it? He says, well, if you have it filled, you can't put any more into it. I'm not quoting it exactly. It was very pithy and true. But the moral of the story is you have to leave something. There has to be something there to receive more. So the don't know mind, we receive everything that is. The more we know, the more we block out and cut off. I'm not saying don't know, because this world runs on know. Our ordinary world, we have to know to function. Have to know what a red light is, how to turn the water on. You know, basic things. We need to be knowledgeable about our culture. And we don't negate that. We're trying to add to our culture, add to reality. Not that we're adding to it, but expanding our view, our experience of reality. That's what this is about. Our experience of reality. On his deathbed, the Buddha said, he gave a very powerful series of talks the 3 days before he died. In one of them, he said, be a lamp unto yourself. So your experience.
He said, be
a lamp unto yourself. your experience. You can trust your experience to guide you. Don't listen to what I say. Listen to your experience. Any other questions? Excuse me?
Another question.
Yes.
In your exchange with Violet just now, you referred to the culture, somehow bringing it into the culture, or is that what I heard?
No, I'm saying this ordinary world. We're not putting down the ordinary world.
No, I know. I know you're not. But
yeah.
I guess my question is, if every, it occurred to me to ask, if let's say more people were engaged in this practice, just like, you know, on a massive scale, just, you know, many more people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say if this practice were as common as other religions or other, you know, practices that are out there in the culture, how might the culture be different? Is there something that would develop culturally, and culture is all interconnected, you know, averaging in some sense of what is out there and who we are out there, how might the world or reality, culture, whatever word you want to use there, be different?
Well, the teachings or the mythology of our practice is the Maitreya Buddha. The coming Buddha will have that effect on the world in the age of Aquarius. I don't know anything about that, but I'm just giving you that as a morsel to chew on if you'd like. I don't know if it's true. But yeah, it's possible that we could get to so-called critical mass. Anything is possible. But right now, I think very few people practice. I sat down a few years ago and just penciled out in an envelope, and I figured about maybe 0.02% of humans ever sat zazen. So it's very, very few. I mean, this is a body practice. Not many people are going to come in and do this to themselves. And not many people have the intuition of the importance of it. But it's been here for 2,500 years. It has sustainability. I don't believe it's going away. But it might happen. We just can't say. What that world will be like would be something. Excuse me?
Would it be any different at all?
Well, I think the mental consciousness of humans would be fairly different. If we treated each other with respect and kindness and didn't argue and weren't greedy. weren't narcissistic and all the rest. I hope so. Any other questions? Okay. Well, then we'll just close that off. There, Bambas. I vow to save them. Dharma is inexhaustible. I vow to attain them. Dharma's gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.